For far too long, the left in Canada has been isolated, fractured, and divided. We need to find some common ground and unite in our struggles. To this end, a conference is being organized called Rebuilding the Left, and it hopes to be the first step in building a structured anti-capitalist organization that can carry out joint work and discussion amongst progressive people and groups. Please join us on October 27th and 28th at the Ontario Institute for Studies and Education, 252 Bloor Street, West Toronto. For more information on the Rebuilding the Left conference or for registration, please call the Rebuilding the Left Organizing Committee at 516-2966 or email rebuildingtheleft@yahoo.com.
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to CKLN in Toronto. It's happening. Okay.
And you're listening to Saturday Morning Live here on CKLN 88.1 FM. My name is Bailo Sanchez. We come to you every Saturday from 10 o'clock to 1 o'clock. Joining me on the line now is Manuel Rosenthal. Manuel is a physician and a surgeon, former director of the Institute for the Prevention of Violence at the El Valle University of Cali, Colombia, also a Colombian Deputy Minister of Health in 1993. He's also worked with the Cree, the Dene, and the Inuit communities, coordinating health development projects in northern Saskatchewan. In Toronto, he is a member of the Research and International Support for Colombia, RISC, and LASOS, a coalition of Canadian organizations establishing progressive partnerships with Colombia. Wow, that's a long list. Thank you, Manuel, for being with us. Good afternoon.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Okay. Manuel, why don't we talk first about your recent visit to Colombia? We've been talking a lot about Colombia on CKLN 88.1, about the Plan Colombia, about the current situation of violent that exists in Colombia. This conference that you went to, I believe it's a democracy and peace conference.
It was a conference organized by three universities, Antioquia, Bolivariana, and the Carlos III Institute from Spain. It took place in Medellin. It was a three-day conference, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of last week, and it was called Peace and Democracy. Its purpose was to bring together in an academic environment all the different perspectives and positions around conflict, war, and possible solutions to these problems. So the conference brought in people such as representatives from FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, who spoke on a teleconference to the audience and responded questions, followed by the commander of the paramilitary forces, who sent a video where he read a speech on the subject responding to questions, and a mayor of the Armed Forces of Colombia, who's also a historian and presented his views, also a member of parliament in Colombia, many other people, indigenous people, and so on. I was invited to present on globalization and violence. So it was listening to different perspectives and debating them.
What did you find to be the most, the thing that sticks in your mind the most from the conference? What was different about this one? I know that you've participated in others before.
Well, what was different was several things, but one of the most outstanding ones was that you would have in one auditorium paramilitary forces, the Revolutionary Armed Forces, the army, and the parliament of Colombia speaking at the same time, and then a broad variety of people with different perspectives listening to their point of view and actually having the possibility to analyze and debate these things. But what became obvious about the situation of Colombia now is that there is a conflict between a growing peace negotiation process and the need for it, and the will Colombians have to see these processes develop and succeed, and then the those that are interested in war and benefiting from war, that seem to have more power than those that want peace to carry on with the process. And I include in this both the wealthy corporations within and outside of Colombia, and most of all the United States with its Plan Colombia, a 1.4 $5 billion, mostly military intervention within Colombia that is actually threatening to destroy a very difficult and developing peace process.
Did you sense optimism there, or did you sense that there was a real a sense that the like you say, those who are interested in war have so much power and are investing so much in this? This is a huge amount of military assistance that Colombia is now receiving, more than it ever has, and it was already receiving so much. How do people deal with that?
Well, the general feeling in Colombia, and particularly at the conference, is one of major concern. People fear that everybody tells you that things are going to get a lot worse very soon unless some kind of miracle takes place. The parallel that was made is very useful. It's one where one compared the time when the arms race was taking place between the two blocs, the Soviet bloc and the US or NATO. The situation is very similar now in Colombia. The U.S. aid to the military and to the armed forces of Colombia through Plan Colombia has led the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia and ELN to begin a major race to arm themselves as well. So the argument from both sides is that they need to arm each other to be in better conditions to negotiate, which actually leads to involving most of the civilians population in the conflict, and then closing the doors for a negotiated solution. So there is major fear and the feeling everywhere that the war is going to extend all over the surface of the country. And there were several presentations of a known fact now that this conflict will extend throughout the Latin American region and is already involving the Andean region as a whole. So we are going to see, and that's everybody's prediction there, save one or two exceptions, we're going to see an extension of the war within Colombia and throughout the Latin American region.
And certainly with the instability over the last 10 days or so in Peru, there's also, of course, a lot of concern that things could turn for the worse in Peru as well. Manuel, I want to ask you specifically, you spoke about globalization, and you also mentioned the corporations that are involved there. Let's talk specifically maybe about a few cases or just briefly about the Canadian corporate involvement in Colombia and how they are involved in keeping this war happening.
There wasn't a specific discussion on Canadian involvement, although there was a scholar that was invited there, Stephen Randall, for the University of Calgary, who spoke mostly about United States foreign security policy, and there was somebody from Geneva who spoke about the U.S. policy around drug trade and so on, and the mistakes and the misconceptions around Plan Colombia. But I can tell you in general, one, there's ongoing research now about Canadian interest in Colombia. There is more increasing information coming through about oil interests, Canadian oil interests in the area of Putumayo in southern Colombia. It's part of the Colombian Amazon, and it will be the target for fumigation and armed activity supported by the U.S., with U.S. helicopters as part of Plan Colombia and so on. There's a map of the Colombian oil company, Ecopetrol, that shows the different regions of the country. And in Putumayo, which is the area where most of Plan Colombia is going to be made effective, I would say 70% of the area is going to be explored or exploited by Canadian corporations. So Canada's corporations certainly have a role in there. There's a lot more research that is needed to illustrate this issue, but it has to be unveiled. At the same time, there is a lot of involvement from the Canadian government and NGOs and so on the other end of the spectrum, in support for human rights and in support for alternative solutions different to that of war and so on. So there are interests, and we need to pay a lot more attention to this. One example that many people are already aware of is a Canadian Crown Corporation involved in URA. That's in the northern part of the country where a big dam is being constructed and a previous dam was constructed, URA, in the territory of the Embera Catio people, indigenous people of the area. One of them visited us here in Canada and went to Parliament not long ago. The Embera Catio, as we were at the conference last week with international presence within Colombia, the paramilitary forces took away, retained 20 people from the Embera Catio, murdered 4, and then murdered a 5th one. The Emberas from one community, 200 people, had to abandon the community and run in fear of the return of the paras, who promised to come back and kill more people. Now, the connection between these happenings and multinational projects is obvious. There's an interest to build a big hydroelectric dam in that area that would produce and generate electricity that would be exported all the way up to New Mexico, destroying native land permanently. The project would only survive for 20 years, yet it would destroy a millenary culture, an environment, sacred territory, and the right of people to live in peace. And that is one example of why there is an ongoing war in Colombia.
Now, there's also the case of the UWA and Occidental Petroleum, which, by the way, is a company that Al Gore, the environmental vice president and soon-to-be candidate for presidency, is involved in. Tell us a little bit about UWA, because they have a very particular struggle in Colombia, indigenous people fighting with the petroleum companies.
Yeah, the UWA are in the northeastern part of Colombia, nearing Venezuela. They're extraordinary and exceptional indigenous people. In about, in the 17th century, mid-17th century, the Spanish were exploiting gold in the area and enslaving indigenous people around it, around their territory. The UWA are known as the thinking people. That's what UWA means when translated. These are the people who know how to speak. They were recognized by the other indigenous cultures around them as the people who never warred against the other ones and always managed to talk their way into peace. These people were going to be enslaved when the Spanish conquistadores were searching for gold, and they refused to become enslaved. So what they did is they put their children into clay pots and walked backwards onto a cliff, and more than 4,000 native people killed themselves. In fact, the river that used to flow at the base of that cliff runs in another direction because of the numbers of corpses that were there. Now, the King of Spain at that time, recognizing their bravery and dignity, forbid any Spanish colonizer to get even close to their territory and recognize their bravery and their right to their land and culture. They were left alone for about 400 years. And ever since 1940, Occidental Petroleum Company, as well as Shell, started explorations and found large oil deposits in the sacred territory, the Samoré, as it is known.
Right. A
struggle has ensued since the 1980s, where Occidental has tried to have these people removed from their territory, and in 1985, they threatened to kill themselves, commit suicide again, if they were removed. That has led to the government to stop the exploration and then again to order it back and forth. In fact, during this process, the director of Occidental in Colombia, the CEO in Colombia, has accused them of being guerrilla members, which has allowed paramilitary forces to act on them and kill some of the UWA leaders. It also has played all kinds of dirty tricks, whereas in February of this year, the armed forces asked to go through UWA territory. In goodwill people, the UWAs allowed them to go through, and as they were going through, they chased them with tear gas and beat them. 3 children ran into the water to escape in fear and died, drowned in the water. Then with protests throughout the world and their leaders coming even to speak at the shareholders convention of the Occidental Petroleum Company, and the government, the president of Colombia was in New York at the Summit of the Americas recently, the Millennium Summit,
yes,
and stopped at the Occidental Petroleum's office. A week later, ordered an eviction of the UWA people from their territory so that the land could be exploited.
Jeez.
And last week, the UWA presented the official document where the Spanish king recognized their ownership of their land after they committed suicide in the 17th century. With that document, the government, through international and national law, cannot at all exploit that land or evict them from there. Yet it is carrying on with the process of exploration and exploitation of the land. So the struggle of the UWA is similar to that of the Embera Catío or the Nazca or the black people in the Pacific Coast in Colombia.
Mm.
The real war that is going on in Colombia is one between autonomies of different peoples to protect the land, save the land, and guarantee a future for everyone, and against the extractive initiatives of multinational corporations with the support of the Colombian government, army, and paramilitary forces. The UWA are an example of what's going on there.
Manuel, you've worked as in health development in the north, North Saskatchewan, actually, with Cree and Dene and Inuit communities. When you think about those experiences and having gone through that, what connections do you see?
Oh, I'm glad you asked me that question, because I had the opportunity to work up north, as you say, and the lessons learned and the connections between the indigenous peoples of Colombia and the indigenous peoples here were extraordinary. Both peoples were trying either to protect or to recover their own cultural values and identity. Their very strong links to the land and the fact that they believe they're alive to protect the land they live in, the concept of territory rather than the ownership of land, and territory being the sisterhood and brotherhood with all living things, and the fact that human beings depend on the life and the protection of nature to survive, and in fact that we are part of nature and without it we cannot survive, led to struggles in northern Saskatchewan to protect against uranium mining, logging corporations that came around, and also to recover rights over the land and to its protection. So it is the same story, the same problems, and I'm sure you've observed, and so have others, that throughout the Americas, from the north to the south, indigenous peoples, including Chiapas, Conaye in Ecuador, the Bolivian people, people in Peru, the Mapuches in Chile, the Lubicon in Saskatchewan and Alberta, everywhere, indigenous peoples are moving forward to try and save the land from, as they call it in Colombia, the second wave of invasion. The first one had started 500 years ago. A second one has come, and they're organizing to resist it for all of us and hopefully with all of us.
Manuel, it's been wonderful speaking with you. I look forward to being in touch with you again. And thank you very much.
Thank you, and take care, please.
Ciao, Manuel.
Bye.
Manuel Rosenthal is in Toronto, a member of RISC, Research and International Support for Colombia, and LASOS, a coalition of Canadian organizations establishing progressive partnerships with Colombia. This is Manu Chao and a track entitled Por el Suelo.
El general en jefe del Ejército Libertador del Sur, Emiliano Zapata, manifiesto zapatista en Nahua.
Por el suelo hay una compadrita que ya nadie se para a mirar. Por el suelo hay una mamacita que se muere de no respetar. Pachamama, te veo tan triste. Pachamama, me pongo a llorar. Esperando la última ola, cuídate, no te vaya a mojar. Escuchando la última rola, mamacita, te invito a bailar. Por el suelo camina mi pueblo, por el suelo hay un agujero, por el suelo camina la raza, mamacita te vamos a matar. Esperando la última ola, Pachamama me muero de pena. Escuchando la última rola, mamacita te invito a bailar.
Por el suelo camina mi pueblo, por el suelo moliendo condena. Por el suelo el infierno quema, por el suelo la raza va ciega.
Esperando la última ola, Pachamama me muero de pena. Escuchando la última rola, mamacita te invito a bailar.
Manu Chao here on CKLN 88.1 FM, Saturday Morning Live, comes to you every Saturday from 10 o'clock to 1 o'clock. My name is Pedro Sanchez, and Norman Otis Richmond also was with us earlier this morning interviewing Rachel Manley, and he'll be back with you here on Saturday Morning Live next Saturday, the first Saturday of October. Joining me on the telephone now from Santiago, Chile, is Sebastian Brett. Sebastian, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Thanks for being with us today. Sebastian works with Human Rights Watch. He's a researcher for the Andean region. Sebastian, we want to spend most of our conversation today talking about Peru and the recent resignation of President Fujimori, and of course the flight of Vladimiro Montesinos, who is the spy chief, not official, but always has had a bit of an unofficial role in the Peruvian government for many years, and somebody who has attracted a lot of curiosity. We will talk about that very shortly. But first, I wanted to ask you to bring us up to date on the situation in Chile in what regards the judgment or the process, the judicial process against former dictator Augusto Pinochet.
Right.
What can you tell us? We know that October 9th was a date that had been set for the questioning of Augusto Pinochet by Judge Guzman. Has that changed?
Well, it looks like the date's been set back because Judge Guzman has now finally decided to have some medical tests done on General Pinochet, which he is actually obliged to do by law. But the timing of this was not clear, and it's now clear that he's going to do those tests before he actually questions Pinochet. And it's conceivable, though I think unlikely, but it's conceivable that on the basis of those tests, simply he could reach the conclusion that Pinochet was not fit to stand trial.
What is your sense of what the reaction would be to that, given what has happened in the last couple of days in Indonesia, with Suharto being excused also for medical reasons from being tried, and of course the situation in the streets of Indonesia is very, very tense and very violent.
Right.
What do you think would happen in Santiago or in Chile?
Well, frankly, I think it's unlikely that Judge Guzman would actually rule that Pinochet was unfit to stand trial on the basis of the kind of test that he's required to run by law, because the Chilean law is actually quite strict in the circumstances in which it says that somebody is not fit to stand trial on medical grounds. And strictly speaking, the only grounds that are relevant here is if Pinochet is actually declared to be insane or so sick mentally, I'm saying, in such a bad state mentally that he simply can't, be held responsible for his actions.
Right. And this process is...
I think that that's very unlikely on the basis of the medical reports that we know that exist up to the present.
Now, this questioning would happen in the context of a case known as the Caravan of Death. Can you tell us briefly about that case and what step in the process it's at right now?
Well, the Caravan of Death, as you probably know, was a military operation conducted on Pinochet's orders in October 1973, in which more than 70 prisoners were taken out of jail and summarily executed. Pinochet, this is one of the human rights crimes that which Pinochet is most directly implicated because this group was acting on his orders. And many of the officials involved subsequently went on to occupy important roles in the DINA, which is Pinochet's secret police, subsequently. Pinochet is actually accused of having commanded this operation, having given orders for this operation. And the crime is kidnapping. As you probably know, the Supreme Court has ruled that kidnapping, if the fate of the victims has not been clarified and it's not been possible to establish that they were actually killed, the meaning of that is that the crime would not be covered by the amnesty law.
So
essentially, there's been a loophole which has enabled this case to go forward against Pinochet.
Thank you for that, Sebastian. We'd like to turn now to the issue of Peru. We saw the resignation the announcement that Alberto Fujimori, the president of Peru, will not run in the elections that he is now calling for. We're not clear as to when those elections might take place. We understand that President Fujimori is in Washington as we speak, negotiating, one presumes, with the Organization of American States and with the United States, perhaps. He was able to secure fleeing of his spy chief to Panama. I understand that Panama had actually rejected having Vladimiro Montesinos go and seek asylum there initially, and then they have accepted him to go there. What do you know about this situation? What's the latest news on this?
Well, I think that the President Moscoso of Panama is still to make a decision, finally, on whether to grant Montesinos asylum. And what is quite clear is that there's a very strong current of opinion in Panama, which is absolutely against this, coupled with the fact that this has drawn very strong criticism from not only the Peruvian opposition, but also all of the most well-known international human rights organization protested about the action of the OAS, its role in trying to get Montesinos asylum in Panama. And so I think there is a lot of pressure on President Moscoso to actually turn that down, although one has to say that the U.S. Government has strongly backed this kind of solution to the Peruvian crisis, if it is indeed a solution.
Is it, in fact, a crisis? What is the sense there, as the Andean region's Human Rights Watch researcher, what is your sense of what has happened over the last 10 days or so and the impact that it potentially could have or the impact that it is having on the region as a whole?
Well, I think as far as Peru is concerned, the thing that the incident that detonated this whole crisis, which was the revelation of this video in which a spy chief, Montesinos, was actually depicted, seen offering a bribe to a congressman to persuade him to change sides. I think that this event was, the revelation of that video was one of two incidents which have really changed the situation fundamentally in Peru. The other, of course, was possible involvement of the Peruvian army, sectors of the Peruvian army and intelligence service in arms trafficking to the Colombian guerrilla,
yes.
Which clearly is, if those allegations are substantiated, is an extremely serious action which threatened to destabilize the situation in the whole region.
Indeed.
But basically, I think what we're seeing now is the unraveling of Fujimori's power in Peru. And quite ironically, I think that the fact that Montesinos is now in Panama has really brought home very sharply just how dependent Fujimori was on Montesinos and how relatively adrift he's become since Montesinos is no longer there to shore up the regime. And what it looks like is doing is that Montesinos is now appealing to the OAS and the international community to shore up his government against what appears to be possibly a military insurrection on the part of army officers who are still loyal to Montesinos and were actually put in, installed in power by him over the last couple of years or so.
What about his role specifically over the last 10 years in this government? We know that he's been involved with this government from the very beginning. What can you tell us from the perspective of Human Rights Watch, that the role that Montesinos has played directly when it comes to human rights violations in Peru?
Well, I mean, I think there are two stages of this. The first stage was basically 1992 to about 1995, when Montesinos' role was most clearly related to counter-subversion and counter-terrorist activities. And in this context, there are at least two extremely serious human rights crimes for which he's considered directly responsible. One of them was the kidnapping and murder of 9 students and a teacher from the University La Cantuta in 1992, and the other was a massacre in 1991. Both these crimes have been attributed to a death squad which was allegedly created by Montesinos. Then you have a situation in 1995 when Congress passes an amnesty which leads to the release of members of the death squad which were implicated in those crimes. Following that, you have Montesinos directly involved in a series of actions intended to intimidate the opposition and prevent a movement against Fujimori's re-election. And so the last 5 years of the 90s, more or less, you could see Montesinos playing a clear role as Fujimori's right hand, as it were, involved in intimidation of opposition journalists, phone tapping of opposition politicians, a movement to remove control of the opposition press from the owners of newspapers and television stations. Whole series of actions essentially aimed at procuring Fujimori's re-election this year, in the elections this year.
In terms of the opposition now and what the possibilities are, how do you see this unfolding? What are some of the biggest concerns now that there seems to be a vacuum that has been created, although, like you mentioned, many of the military commanders who were placed there by Montesinos and Fujimori stand still they still are in power. How do you see this unfolding? What are some of the scenarios that we might be seeing?
Well, I think this is a tricky question, because I think the opposition is going to be increasingly divided over whether it's best to go with Fujimori for the rest of the time before the elections are held, on the grounds that the presence of Fujimori as head of state, even though he becomes increasingly a lame duck president, is a better alternative than the instability that could result from a kind of interim caretaker government, especially when it's known that a very powerful group within the armed forces, are basically hostile to this whole process of democratic transition. So I think there will be a division there, because equally a strong section of the opposition are thoroughly opposed to the idea of Fujimori remaining in power, and consider that this will simply be, a recipe for further manipulation of the game by Fujimori to try and preserve, if not his role in a future government, at least protect himself from investigations and secure himself impunity. I think the opposition has to face some very, very challenging questions in the coming weeks.
We know that human rights workers in Peru and others, grassroots movement, have constantly for the last 10 years, and certainly for the last 7 or 8 years since 1992, been talking about a government that is characterized first and foremost by repression, by human rights violations. Is it your sense that this is ultimately what has brought down this regime, if in fact this regime is crumbling as it seems to be, that the human rights issue was such that it sort of the pot boiled over, so to speak?
Yes, except that I think that it's probably slightly misleading to think of the human rights issue as the most important issue here. I mean, I think that in terms of massive gross violations of human rights, these have definitely declined over the last 5 years or so. Indeed, as the threat from terrorism has declined, and what we've seen in at least the last 3 years or so has more been a systematic violation of political rights directed at the political opposition, rather than human rights violations committed in the context of counterinsurgency, which is what characterized the earlier period. So, it's not quite as simple as that. I think that what really characterizes this government since Fujimori was re-elected in 1995 is its systematic attempts to undermine the process of the rule of law in particular, and democratic change in the country, coupled with other allegations which have involved especially Montesinos and the SIN in, for example, complicity with drug trafficking and its recent charge of involvement in arms dealing to the Colombian guerrilla groups. So I think it's not strictly accurate to see, traditional human rights violations as they existed in the late 1980s and early 1990s as the main factor here.
I should have referred to perhaps social and economic rights, the issue of labor rights, the rights of unions to organize freely. What is the situation that has emerged under this government?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to talk about social economic rights. I mean, I don't think that the government has particularly taken any measures that directly affect socioeconomic rights, but one can obviously point to, the great poverty that exists in Peru and the fact that the Fujimori policies clearly haven't been successful in terms of employment and combating poverty in Peru. But I don't think you've seen sort of massive attacks on freedom of trade unions or that kind of action.
Sebastian, is there anything else that you would like to add in reflection and as you look forward to this situation unfolding and continue to develop over the days and weeks?
Well, of course, the situation is pretty unpredictable. I mean, it seems to be changing from day to day. But, I mean, I think that this is going to give plenty of room for thought in the future as to the meaning of this whole experience, especially because here we have a situation of a very small clique of people who basically held a country to ransom, virtually by their control of information and a willingness to use information to blackmail people into some kind of co-opt opposition and other people into basically some kind of terrorized silence. I think that the implications for the region as a whole are extremely important because they indicate that perhaps the greatest threat to democracy in Latin America now, it doesn't come from, the traditional type of military coup of the 70s and early 80s, rather from groups within society who are prepared to use underhand methods to bribe, corrupt, blackmail their way into power and use the same methods basically to intimidate the opposition while retaining the trappings of democracy. And this clearly represents a great challenge to the ability of the OAS to actually protect democracy in the future.
Sebastian, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. We look forward to speaking to you in the future.
Okay, thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Sebastian Brett is a researcher with Human Rights Watch for the Andean region. He spoke to us from Santiago, Chile. And we're going to go to some music from Peru right now. This is Manuel Chaprado from a CD entitled Sacra and a track entitled Cuculinay, Celebration.
זמן סיריקותי כזל הנחייה
Bookstore proudly presents Fall 2000 Author Series. Friday, September 22nd at 7 p.m., Vago Press author Emma Donahue will read from her new novel, Slam Lama Slam Lama Slam. On Saturday, September 23rd at 7 p.m., Random House author Shauna Singh Baldwin will celebrate the paperback edition of What the Body Remembers. On Thursday, September 28th at 7:30 p.m., Canadian Scholars Press author intellectual Hermanni Banerjee will read from her latest book, The Dark Side of the Nation. On Saturday, October 21st at 5 p.m., U of T Press author activist Leo Vasco will support her debut book, Temporary Work. All these events are free at the Toronto Women's Bookstore at 73 Harbord Street at Harbord and Spadina. For more information about these events and upcoming events, which will include Jeanette Winterson, Shani Mutu, Ella Shohad, and Sonia Sanchez with California's hip-hop diva, Medusa. Please call 416-922-8744 or check out our proud sponsor, Now Magazine. This is a Toronto Women's Bookstore and CKLN presentation.
Yo, what's up, world? Yo, this is Big M.A. Uno, M1, know what I mean? Holding it down for Dead Prez. And when I keep my ear to the street, know what I mean? I hear the heartbeat of the people. I hear the working class all worldwide, know what I mean? On word of mouth, let's get free.
Tune in to CKLN 88.1 FM every Monday night at 7 p.m. for Word of Mouth News with Mike Brito. Word of Mouth Mondays brings you the news and views that the mainstream doesn't want you to hear. Joined by regular features Red Alert Radio, the program of the New Socialists, and Radio Antifa, the weekly feature of anti-racist action, Word of Mouth Mondays is coming with the anti-racist working class perspective. CKLN 88.1 FM, your conscious connection.
The world is yours. The world is yours.
And this brings us to the end of Saturday Morning Live for this Saturday, September 30th, the year 2000. A couple of announcements to make. There will be a benefit show tomorrow, Sunday, October 1st, from 5 to 11 p.m. This is taking place at the 360 Club, 326 Queen Street West. It's a benefit for the victims of the fire last month at Shannon Court, which is near King Street West and Dufferin in Parkdale. It'll be a $10 entry fee. And again, it's a benefit for the victims of the fire last month at Shannon Court. That's at the 360 Club. As I give thanks to Manuel Rosenthal, one of our guests this on the show today, Manuel Rosenthal spoke to us about Colombia. He will be speaking coming up this Tuesday, October 3rd, at the International Student Center, 33 St. George. That's from 5 to 7 p.m. It's organized by OPERC Toronto. For more information, 978-7770. That's Manuel Rosenthal speaking on Roots of Resistance, a panel discussion on indigenous land rights. Again, that's Tuesday, October 3rd. And I want to thank Manuel Rosenthal for joining us on the show today. A lot of other people to thank. Sebastian Brett from Human Rights Watch in Santiago, Chile. Professor Michelle Chosudovsky, who spoke to us from Quebec. And also Marjolina Ripo, who just recently returned from Yugoslavia. That is the show. Also want to say thank you and greetings to Norman Otis Richmond. He interviewed Rachel Manley this morning. Also the folks from Metro Network for Social Justice were with us today. I want to thank all of those people. My name is Pedro Sanchez. You've been tuned to Saturday Morning Live for the last 3 hours. Coming up is The Power Move. I leave you with a little bit of music from the Asian Dove Foundation. What can I say? I'm so predictable. You're tuned to Saturday Morning Live. This is the last couple of seconds of the show. CKLN 88.1. Keep in mind that just a few weeks down the road, we bring you Fun Fest, where we all come together and as a community, make sure that CKLN can stay on the air for another year by fundraising through our 88.1 signal. So make sure you stay tuned for that. Again, take care. Have a good weekend.
Obituary, the new release.
Join world-renowned poet-playwright Pedro Pietri for the Toronto launch of the new edition of the acclaimed collection of poetry, Puerto Rican Obituary, an exciting night of New Yorican poetry, theater, and video featuring El Reverendo Pedro Pietri, New York City poet Nancy Mercado, Tanisha Sribagirathe, and video filmmaker Jorge Lozano.
Saturday, October 21st at 9 p.m., The 360 Club, 326 Queen Street West, followed by Music with No Capitalista. Admission is $10. Brought to you by CKLN and CHRY. More info, 929-1834.